in downtown Butler. I'm Tracy Morgan in the Next Year Bank studios with WYSR 680 AM with your news at noon. Your news time is just about 12:30. Next Year Bank, your hometown community bank. Dave Mularkey's up next, and of course he has It's Your Turn. Thanks so much for joining us, and have a good day.
And now, it's your turn with Dave Mularkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn. Weekdays from 12:30 to 2 on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn. 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Mularkey.
Good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on the Thursday edition of It's Your Turn. It's the 15th of June. Can you believe we're halfway through June already? I'm still not quite ready for Memorial Day weekend. And here we are halfway through June. Wow. And we've got summer weather, too, all of a sudden. Huh? It took a long time for the hot stuff to get here, but man, we've had it in spades for the past few days. This has been one hot week. And, you know, it's nice. I mean, it's a little uncomfortable. There's no question about it. You have to plan your day a little bit differently. You certainly have to take care of your heavy chores earlier in the morning. Get them out of the way so you can take it a little easy later in the day, in the heat of the day. Temperatures have been well up into the 80s now for several days in a row, and the humidity level has been high, too, so that's been a significant problem as well. Open talk on the first portion of the program today. 283-2525 is our number. Later on the program today, we will be chatting with, you know, Russia's been in the news a lot recently, right? We have the continued investigation going on in Washington. Seems like it's been going on forever. Vladimir Putin, Russia, any connection? Have they been hacking us? Most of our nation's intelligence agencies believe indeed they were trying to influence the election last year. We're going to talk about the daughter of one of the most notorious Russian leaders of the past, Joseph Stalin's daughter. And we'll be chatting about that with historian Rosemary Sullivan. Joe Stalin had a daughter. Joseph Stalin, of course, you can remember all the pictures you've seen from World War II with Stalin and Roosevelt and Churchill, you know, the conference at Yalta and the other times that they were together, classic pictures. Well, Stalin had a daughter, and she lived for quite a while in the United States. Yeah. Svetlana was her name. Kind of an interesting story. She had a rough life, very rough life. We'll find out about that a little bit later. And then we're going to be talking, give you some tips if you're concerned about heart disease. A medical doctor, Joel Furman, will be joining us. We're going to be talking about heart disease and specifically how to adjust your diet. Maybe some of us need to radically adjust our diet to try to fend off heart disease. I don't know. Can you reverse heart disease, too? I don't know. Joel Furman will be with us. You've probably seen him on TV. He's had his own programs on PBS, and he's been on, you know, some of the other shows, Dr. Oz. So that's the lineup for today's program. Open talk to begin with. 283-2525 is our number, 283-2525. It was chilling to watch. Now, yesterday during the program here in the early afternoon, we knew about the shooting that had gone on in outside of Washington, D.C., Alexandria, Virginia, and the fact that there were several people who were wounded, We didn't really have a whole lot of information at that time. It turns out that the shooter died of wounds that were inflicted by police when they finally brought him down. And fortunately, at this point, although one of his shooting victims is still in critical condition, that's a congressman, Steve Scalise of Louisiana, it looks like the others will recover. But last night, boy, I was watching some of the news on TV, and they had video of this shooting incident. Now, I'm not sure where the video came from, whether it was from some of the people that were on duty there or it was a surveillance camera. I don't know. I mean, it was just a ball field. It was a pretty nice one, but a municipal ball field. I don't know if they had surveillance cameras or not. The video was chilling. Did anybody see it? You know, you couldn't see the shooter. In fact, you could hear some of the police officers, some of the security people who had rushed to the scene yelling out, "Where is he? Do you know where he is?" Somebody said, "I think he's behind home plate." They were yelling. They didn't know where this guy was. And he was just firing off round after round. I'm no expert on guns. I'm a gun owner. I certainly am not an expert. But it sounded to me like it had to be an assault rifle. He had a rifle and a handgun. I know that from the wire reports this morning. He had a rifle and a handgun, and it had to be an assault rifle because it was a semi-automatic. He was just firing off shots, and they let the video run for about 2 minutes on TV last night, the news I was watching. And it was chilling. It was very, very sobering. You see a couple of people lying out on the field. Obviously, they've been wounded. This member of Congress, Steve Scalise, was hit in the hip, and he was lying out near second base in the infield. And they couldn't even get to him until the security people could and the police brought the shooter down. They just had to leave him lying there. So it was very chilling to watch. Very chilling. This isn't the first member of Congress to be shot. Gabby Gifford, former congresswoman from Arizona, was shot several years ago. She was shot in the head at some event out in her home state, some sort of a town hall event or rally or something. Very, very sobering. These are the sorts of things that we think about happening in, you know, undeveloped countries, banana republics or something like that. It's sobering to see it here in the U.S. But then again, maybe we just conveniently forget. Do you realize how many of our presidents have been either assassinated or been the victim of attempted assassinations? There have been a lot. And we're up to, 45 presidents now. There have been a lot of them. Several of them assassinated, others shot and wounded, others shot at and missed. Ronald Reagan was critically wounded. We didn't know how critically he was until after he had recovered. Kennedy, of course. Lincoln was the first assassinated. Garfield. William McKinley was assassinated. That's how Teddy Roosevelt became president. He was vice president at the time when McKinley was assassinated. There were attempts on Gerald Ford a couple of times. Yeah, it's you know, my first reaction was, oh, gosh, that's two that I can think of. And then I started thinking about the presidents. Wow. Sobering indeed. 283-2525 is the number, 283-2525. I also watched a press conference yesterday. It was on in the late afternoon. I was watching it live. I assume that it was replayed on the evening news on TV, where they had House Republican leader and Democratic Republican leader, a guy from Pittsburgh, as a matter of fact, Mike Doyle. They were both serving as managers of these baseball teams. Apparently, this is an annual thing. It's been going on for decades, where Republican members of the House face a team of Democratic members from the House in a charity baseball game to raise money. And they've raised millions of dollars over the years. I have this event once a year. I was not familiar with it. But these two gentlemen are both older gentlemen. Mike Doyle and his Republican counterpart. And they had a very, in a way, it was a reassuring press conference. They both said that they were concerned about the level of violent talk and violent reactions in our American society these days. The way people are so polarized, very concerned about it. They both vowed that they were going to try to make sure that there's none of that that ever surfaces in the House. You seldom see it on the House floor. But even in their personal interactions, they said, we have to set the example. And I don't know, maybe it was just the fact that it was the same day as the shooting, but it seemed kind of reassuring to me to watch that press conference. 283-2525 is our number, 283-2525. Will that lead to more regulations on the purchase of guns? Not taking away guns, that's never going to happen, but more stringent regulations on background checks. For example, we have to have a background check if you're buying at a gun show or something. I don't know. Will we ban some weapons, namely assault rifles? I don't know. Obviously, we banned some. You can't go out and buy any nuclear weapons, right? You can't go out and buy a howitzer or a tank or a flamethrower. But you are allowed to purchase assault weapons, so-called assault weapons, AK-47-style weapons. There are many others, too, assault-style weapons. Will there be more limitations on those? I don't know. 283-2525 is the number, 283-2525. Many say there are already enough regulations. We don't need any more, whether it's on background checks or on the type of weapons that you're allowed to purchase. Your thoughts, 283-2525. No restrictions on bullwhips, as far as I know. Why would I ever mention that today? Today would have been the birthday of the late Lash LaRue. Anybody remember Lash LaRue? Now, Pat Parker is shaking his head in the control room. Of course, you wouldn't. This goes back a ways. You have to be, I was going to say baby boomer, maybe even a little older than baby boomer to remember Lash LaRue. I think I may have seen one of his B-grade Western. He made a bunch of B-Western movies. Really bad, to be honest with you. They weren't very good. But he was famous for a bullwhip. That was his, that's what he used. It was his weapon of choice. And he really was very talented. His real name was Alfred, by the way, Alfred LaRue. But he was so adept at using the bullwhip that he became known as Lash LaRue. Born on this date in 1917. Died about 10 years ago. How good was he with a bullwhip? Oh, he was so good that when Harrison Ford got the role of Indiana Jones in the first Indiana Jones movie, he went to Lash LaRue, and Lash LaRue taught him how to use a bullwhip, which, of course, was used in many, many scenes in the Indiana Jones series. That was Harrison Ford's teacher, the late Lash LaRue, born on this date, 1917. Also born on this date, by the way, Earl Garner, tremendous jazz musician, composer, pianist, obviously a great piano player. He's the guy that wrote Misty. Great song, Misty. Earl Garner, born on this date in 1921, died very early in life. Had heart trouble in his 50s. He was from Pittsburgh. Did you know that? Pittsburgh native. Yeah. The late Earl Garner. 283-2525. It's Open Talk on the It's Your Turn program today. We will take a break. We will come back with more on the Thursday edition coming up here on WISR in just a moment or so. Have you finished your spring cleaning yet? I'm sure a lot of folks have been done for weeks. I am not yet finished. I did start, but I got waylaid somewhere a couple of weeks ago, and I'm not there yet. I'm not there yet. I only mention this because if you're doing cleaning, and maybe it's not spring cleaning, anytime you're cleaning out a closet or the garage or whatever, consider donating unused and unwanted items to the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Thrift Store. They'll sell those items. Oh, it could be knickknacks, it could be clothing, it could be furniture, it could be anything. They'll sell those items at the thrift store in the Greater Butler Mart. Somebody will be able to use them, and probably at a price that they wouldn't have been able to afford otherwise. Best part of all, the proceeds from the operation of the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Thrift Store all stay right here in Butler County, every penny. And it helps to fund their food bank and their client aid program. And you were going to throw the stuff away anyway, right? Right? So don't put it in the landfill. Consider donating to the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. Their thrift store is in the Greater Butler Mart. That's Route 8, just south of Butler. There's tons of free parking right at the door. Drop-off bins are right inside the door. It's bada-bing, bada-bing. You're in, you're out. And if you got a lot of stuff or big stuff, like furniture or something, call them and they'll come and get it for you. Society of St. Vincent de Paul thrift store in the Greater Butler Mart, Route 8, just south of Butler. We'll be back with more of It's Your Turn here on WISR right after this.
That frightening sound is one we hear quite often throughout the day. Our heart quickens and immediately we wonder what happened. A medical emergency can be frightening. Every tick of the clock crucial. And that's why Butler Ambulance Service is dedicated to be there with every ounce of care possible. Butler Ambulance Service is within minutes of providing you or a loved one with treatment and transportation. Call 282-9595 to find out more. Butler Ambulance Service is a phone call away from serving you.
Thursday edition of It's Your Turn. It's Open Talk. 283-2525 is our number. 283-2525 here on the It's Your Turn program for a Thursday at the halfway point in the month of June. Wow. Let's get to the people. 283-2525. Hi there, caller. This is Dave Malarkey. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Hi, Dave. Are you a hunter?
I have hunted in the past. I have not hunted for some time.
I haven't either. See, you can use a semi-automatic rifle now when you go deer hunts.
Well, I'm a little confused on whether or not that's really been approved. There was some like policy change. It was recommended that they were still awaiting a vote by the Game Commission, and then I thought I heard that the Game Commission approved it, but then I heard later that maybe they didn't. So I really don't know where that stands right now.
I think they approved it for next year in some areas.
I was under the impression that they may have approved it for some game, but not for deer. Now, I could be way off base.
Deer.
Maybe somebody knows.
But
it's a lot more complicated than it should be. I mean, I heard conflicting reports. So.
Anything for money. See, it's probably an extra fee if you want to use your high-powered semi-automatic rifle like they really need it. That's not sportsman at all.
Well, some would argue that it's unfair to use a semi-automatic weapon to hunt deer. It is legal in many other states, however, you know that.
Well, a lot of them states are they don't have the area that we have. Like as far as I don't know. You got to watch because it's. I'd hate to get my house blasted with one, I think I'd be a little upset.
Do you think that it takes away the sporting aspect of hunting?
I think so. Yeah, I don't think there's anything good involved in it. Really don't.
Some would argue that it takes away from the skill of being a great marksman because you can just fire away,
Yeah, even with the bow and arrow now, they got so many. They got the crossbow with telescopic sights with. There's no skill anymore. Anybody could go out and, I'm glad I gave up hunting.
Well, I didn't think about that. You're right. And I don't know whether crossbows have always been legal to hunt deer in Pennsylvania or not. I know they are now, that's for sure.
Oh, you ought to see some of these. I mean, you could spend a couple $1,000s on some of this weaponry they use for so-called sportsmen.
Well, the big thing, thanks a lot. Sure, so long.
Thank you, Dave.
The big thing about archery season, bow hunting, is the skill that you need to get close enough to a deer, to take a deer. You know, you can't shoot from long range like you can with a deer rifle. So I don't necessarily think you need to be a Mohawk or an Algonquin Native American, but it takes a certain amount of skill to sneak up on a deer. Although, from what I understand, I've never hunted with a bow, so I don't have any personal experience. But I think a lot of bow hunters hunt from tree stands. They don't actually sneak up. They hope to allow the deer to sneak up to them. That's my understanding, anyway. I don't know. I guess you can use a crossbow if you're in a tree stand too. I don't know. The rules and regulations of hunting are numerous, and I do believe that any new hunter in Pennsylvania has to take one of those hunter and trapper courses that are offered periodically throughout the year by the Game Commission. And I think it's any new hunter. It doesn't matter how old you are. Now, if you've hunted before, different story from what I understand. But I don't know. As I say, I've not hunted for quite a few years. Many years. 283-2525 is the number. Open talk on the program today. 283-2525. We were talking yesterday about the closing of more and more brick-and-mortar stores, not just locally, but across the country. The announcement last week that Sears Holdings, that's the parent company of both Sears and Kmart and also Sears Auto Centers, they announced last week they're going to be closing 6 more Sears stores around the country. I'm sorry, 16 more Sears stores, 7 Sears Auto Centers, and 49 more Kmarts, including the one in Butler. Of course, the Sears store in Butler, Clearview Mall, closed last summer, I think. Our phone number is 283-2525. Hi, caller. This is Dave Malarkey. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Hey, Dave. Terry.
Hey, Terry. How you doing?
Okay. I have nothing to do, so I like talking to you, and you're my buddy, so let's talk to you all day long here.
Is it hot enough for you, Terry?
Oh, God. Yes. And my cousin wants me to move to Arizona. It was only 107 the other day.
You know, I'm almost positive that I couldn't take the heat in the Southwest. Even in Florida this time of year, it's brutally hot day after day. Now, of course, they have air conditioning, but I'm not real keen on that either all the time.
Well, that's what he was telling me. I said, how's your neighbor doing? He goes, I didn't know I had neighbors. I said, what do you mean? He said, nobody around here sees anybody because everybody has a fence or else it's too hot and you don't want to go outside.
Mm-hmm.
I said, what kind of life is that? I mean,
it's a big draw. I mean, that's where, you know, all of the people, well, most of the people that are moving out of the Northeast, Pennsylvania and the other Northeastern states, are moving to either the Southwest, Arizona and California, or to Florida.
Yeah.
I don't know. It would definitely be too hot for me. I would not be able to do it.
No, I couldn't either. My question, or not a question, but on these assault weapons,
mm-hmm.
Why do you need one? The only thing you can really do with it, well, I see now they're talking about legalizing for deer or whatever, but you can only target practice. I mean, you're going to spend $800 or $900 or more for shooting a couple rounds off.
I've talked with people. In fact, we've talked about it here on the program, and several people have said to me, "Well, it's just fun to shoot." And I don't know. I'm not sure that I can argue with that. I can understand it. I mean, I like to target shoot. I find that enjoyable. I don't do it all the time, but I think it's fun once in a while. But you know, you have to weigh the weigh the dangers. I don't know. When I watched that video of that shooting last night on TV, and that guy just kept shooting that rifle.
Hell yeah.
Just shot after shot. I mean, I didn't even try to count them. It was just bang, 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 bang. It was very unnerving. Very unnerving.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Gary. Hey, take care of yourself in the heat, will you, my friend?
I will, and you do too, dude.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
283-2525 is our number. Open talk. 283-2525. Hi there. This is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Hi. Am I on the air?
Yes, you are. Nice to talk
to
you.
Okay. Yeah, I talked to you a long time ago. I travel on the road quite a bit and for a living, and I listen to your. I'm listening again back in the groove, listening to you.
Well, thank you.
I really enjoy the show.
I appreciate your comment.
I just wanted to get some facts here. I've been watching that semi-auto thing about the hunting. First, let's comment on the hunting thing.
First,
we have to get some definition. People get this very confused with automatic and semi-automatic. Here's the deal. A machine gun, it's one of the things you said you can't buy a howitzer. You can't buy a machine gun. Without a machine gun special license, which is very hard to get and expensive, but a machine gun, when you pull the trigger, it just fires rapidly as long as you have the trigger depressed.
Yep.
A semi-auto you don't have to cock it manually. You just pull the trigger, and it shoots one round at a time as fast as you want to pull the trigger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't have to.
First of all, there's a lot of confusion there. Even the news media gets this back.
Oh, no question. But also with a semi-automatic, you don't have to manually load another round into the chamber. You just keep pulling the trigger as fast as you can, and it automatically loads another round into the chamber.
Yeah, the gas, the action is the gas is from the round you just shot, cocks it and ejects the casing.
Mm-hmm.
But the hunting thing, I follow this real close. I even commented to the Game Commission online. The way it stands now, the new hunting licenses are available now. You're right, there's a million laws. You have to be a lawyer to hunt now. But you have to, you know, if you're hunting spring droplet, you have to have an orange band around the tree. But if you're walking through the woods, you have to have an orange hat on. The new hunting licenses are available in July now. And I'm just ready to get my new book. I got a lifetime license, so all I have to do is get new tags for game and a new rule book.
Mm-hmm.
But from what the latest and greatest I got from the website and the Game Commission is, the Game Commission in March characteristically make the laws for the next hunting season, but they have a meeting in June to finalize it, and it's June.
Mm-hmm.
It's semi-automatic for thoroughbreds and small game. It's small game, which includes the coyotes and whatever. And the Game Commission was most of them. They call it an AR platform. Most of the semi-autos you see for sale, they look like Vietnam era rifles.
Right.
Vietnam, the black, they call it a soft, but whatever it is, it's a semi-auto. It was designed, the .223 caliber, that's a .22 caliber, it's not too big a round of a bullet diameter. It was made to kill people and wound people. It wasn't a good deer caliber. So my problem with, if they would approve it for deer hunting, is 99% of them that are owned right now in circulation are AR platform .223 caliber. You can get them in a .308 caliber, which is a good deer caliber, similar to a .30-06, but it's a very poor caliber, and I personally thought there would be a lot of wounded deer. Not that you're going to mow them down. There'd be some yogis that would probably, go crazy, and I don't know if they were going to limit the magazine capacity or what, but the bottom line is it's not a good deer caliber. It's just a poor deer caliber. So they did turn that down, but it for squirrels, on the other hand, there's a rifle called a Ruger what's the name of it? But it's a Ruger semi-auto's 22, and it's 1022. That's the model number, and it's a great little shooting rifle. It's a wooden stock rifle. You can't tell it's just a regular 22, but It's a sweet caliber for squirrel, for guys want a squirrel hunt, and now you can use it. It only has a 10-round magazine, but, you know, you're not going to assault squirrel anyway, but it's just a nice rifle that you couldn't use except for plinking cans or shooting target before, but now you can take it and have one rifle and do a little bit of both, you know.
Well, that,
so that's the definition of the new rules there.
I appreciate you setting me straight, because I thought I remembered reading that on the wire that, okay, well, now it's not being allowed for deer. And that was really confusing to me, because I thought they'd already approved it. So they did turn it down for deer, at least for another season.
And it's a very poor rifle. You can buy them now as low as $450. I just got a flyer from a big gun shop up north that a semi-auto. But the thing is, you can buy a better deer rifle for half the money. They'll shoot more accurate and be more potent. And there's real no need, although the right to have one is, it's just like it's our Second Amendment. If you want to have one and shoot and target, and you know, there's nothing. It's been proven too, and I have seen documentation and videos where a skilled shooter can shoot within a minute. They can shoot the same amount of rounds by manually loading a 5-round magazine in a semi-auto pistol versus a fully automatic. Not fully automatic, but a semi-automatic with a 10-round capacity, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not that, you know, and there's no, you're not going to regulate wackos like this guy was, and they just need to come down a little harder. They do have extensive background checks on anything you buy now. It didn't used to be like that when I was a kid. You know, you'd buy a deer rifle with Kilpatrick's uptown in Butler, and if it's a deer rifle, a handgun was different. But, yeah, you can... I have a rifle now, but it's still, you have to go through the background check through the system in Harrisburg.
Let me ask you one more question here, because obviously you've got a lot of expertise here. If you go to a gun show, not a sporting goods store or a retail outlet, but just you go to a gun show somewhere, do you have to get a background check there to buy a gun?
Not for hunting rifles, but you have to legally get handguns transferred. Any handgun, which is less than 18 inches barrel length, is why they are one of the classifications. Mm-hmm. So you can buy it from a guy, but then you're going to have to go to a local sports shop and have the transfer done, which can be, you know, whatever they charge you, $3 to $10.
Yeah. Hey, gosh, I really appreciate you setting me straight on several points there. Thanks for taking the time to call in today.
Okay, keep up the good work, Dave.
Thank you. Thanks, my friend.
Yep, bye.
Thanks. There's a guy who knows what he's talking about, huh? Yeah. Well, I really appreciate him clarifying that use of a semi-automatic for deer hunting, because I thought I had read that they changed their minds and disallowed it, and I do believe I read in that same Wire story that it was, they got a lot of negative feedback from hunters who said, in so many words, it's unfair to use a semi-automatic rifle to hunt deer. That's not sporting. And because of all the negative feedback from hunters, they decided that it wasn't going to be approved, after all, for deer. You can use it for certain small game. What did he say? Squirrels. Yeah, and some other stuff, too. But that gentleman hit it right on the head. The rules and regulations for hunting and trapping, for that matter, in Pennsylvania are, I mean, it's a whole book. It's extremely, extremely complex. And not only that, it differs from place to place. It's not the same throughout Pennsylvania. And instead of listing it, I don't know, listen to me, because I don't hunt anymore, but it would seem to me the easiest way to designate where these rules apply would be saying, you know, by county. Okay, in Butler County you can do this. In Clarion County, you can't do this, whatever. But they don't do it that way. They designate wildlife management areas. So when you're reading the rules and regulations, you know, it's while in WM2 as opposed to WM7, and who the heck knows where their boundaries are, right? You got to dig out a map. I mean, it just seemed to be so simple to do it by county, you know. Okay, in Butler County, you're allowed to do this. Armstrong County, you're not. Yeah, whatever. Okay. You know, we haven't talked to the Game Commission in a while. That reminds me, let me make a note here and see if I can, before we get into the big hunting season, we can get a spokesperson for the Game Commission back on the air with us. It was about a year ago we talked to them, maybe a little over a year. 283-2525 is our number. It's Open Talk. You're on the It's Your Turn program today, 283-2525. Most hunters that I know and that I hunted with in the past, as I say, I haven't hunted for many, many years, but they are good sportsmen. You know, that's part of the fun of hunting, you know. Get out in the woods, get out in the open. There's a camaraderie if you're hunting with friends or family, for that matter, and a lot of folks do. And it's the sporting aspect of, you know, being able to take a deer. I mean, it's a lot of skill involved. And I think that's why they had such a negative blowback from hunters, many hunters who thought it was not sporting to be able to use a semi-automatic. 283-2525 is the number. Open Talk, 283-2525. Hi there, caller. This is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Hi there. How are you today?
I'm just fine. Well, actually, I'm a little hot, but hey,
yeah,
that's better. That's better than running the furnace 24 hours a day, right?
Yeah, I got to go out and cut grass, and I don't want to do it. It's just getting too long, though.
Yeah, do it tomorrow morning.
No, I've got to get it done today. Well, the sun's not out. It's been overcast, so it's cool. I called in about one thing that I wanted to tell you. I also, I think I talked to you about it. I had an opportunity to shoot an AK-47.
Mm-hmm.
Well, probably about 18 years ago, and curiosity is why I did it, and I will tell you, it scared the heck out of me. You know, I would never touch it again, but I don't have a problem with people owning them, but like many, I don't think if you can't shoot a deer with a long rifle, you don't need to be out in the woods.
Well, there are many
shotgun,
hunters who feel that way, you know.
Well, yeah, you know, shotgun, but I've called about something else I wanted to bring your attention at. Mr. Dandoy listens to the program a lot. I hope he does. Have you seen the new pictures, the murals that we've hung uptown, historical societies hung up?
Yes, I have. Huh? Well, I've seen some of them. I haven't seen them all.
Right. Do you see anything wrong with them?
Well, the only one that I can remember off the top of my head is the Cooper Cabin mural that's hanging on the side of what is that, Pizza Joe's or whatever, up there by the donut shop.
Yes, and then there's another one, the Benjamin Beatles on the side of the building over there.
You
can go up and touch them. And from the day one when I first seen them putting up, I wanted to call the Historical Society and ask them, don't you think you should be putting it a little bit higher?
Mm-hmm.
I'm afraid with the way people are today, they're going to be ruined. They're going to be defaced.
Well, that's a good point. It could be they had a problem down at the Three Rivers Arts Festival, which wrapped up last week in Pittsburgh. That some of their art was defaced by spray painters.
Yes, you know, well, my first thought, the first day I put them up, I thought to myself, I actually went up on the one Benjamin Beatles and looked at it really close, you know, got a good look at it, and I thought, I can actually touch this. And I don't, all the time and the money and the people that came from all over the world to do these pictures, and they're going to get ruined. So I hope somebody's listening out there that before you put any more up, and take these two, move them up to a higher part of the building. You can't leave them that low.
Well, some of the ones that are actually painted on the buildings are lower, too. You know, I'm thinking of the one across from the Butler Middle School playground.
A lot of them are.
It's on that. That's painted on the building, and that's pretty low. Some of them are pretty high, you know, depends on the building.
Well, the ones I'm talking about, you know, the ones that they had on whatever wood and whatever the surfaces that they painted those on, and to think that the people came from all around the world to do that work, and then you put them where they are, I was like, what's going to stop kids from ruining them? Or young adults, people coming home 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
Please move them.
I hope not.
All right.
Thank you, my friend.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
And you. 283-2525, Open Talk at 283-2525. Hi, caller. This is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Good afternoon, Dave. Hey, I just want to agree with that last caller. I thought the same thing, that some of those are too low. There's one right by the Dunkin' Donuts.
Mm-hmm.
It's very low. And I'd like to think that people are going to be careful with them, but I've seen too many times in the past where these graffiti artists, that's in quotation marks, are attracted to this type of thing, and even though it's right on Main Street, it wouldn't take much time to deface some of those. And another thing I thought was maybe a bad choice, and I don't know the problems that the folks had in selecting locations. I knew it did take some extra money and fundraising to put those up, but there, some of the locations, like the Jeep one, is located at what I feel is a place where you can hardly see it there. I believe that's the one that's on Benjamin Beetle building. It's facing, it's on the west side of the building. And again, tough to find locations, I'm sure. Tough to raise money to do it, but and I hate to be a nagger and a critic, but
no,
that could be a better place.
Positive criticism is fine, and you know, if that's one of the ones that they just hung, it's possible that they, you know, could have second thoughts and move it. I personally haven't seen that one. Does it face the mobile, not the mobile bank, the drive-in bank branch there? What is that? That's PNC.
Yeah, Dave, I think it does face the bank. That's I was surprised to see it there because it just didn't seem like a very good spot, especially with the big Jeep weekend that we had, and you'd almost have to go looking for it to find it or just kind of blunder upon it.
I know why I haven't seen it now that you mention it. That's become... that's the street that's blocked off, isn't it?
You know, it may well be.
I don't think you can only go up that street halfway to the alley. I think that's the street.
Yeah, that might be the one. And I should know my city streets in Butler better, but
that's Newcastle Street, and you can only go up to the alley there because that's where they, you know, sometimes have concerts and stuff in the upper half of that street. So you're right. And the only people who I'm gonna have to check that out later today. But the only people that would see it are the people that are going up just halfway up that street, which is going to be very few people, quite frankly.
You know, I'm driving right toward your station right now, and I'm looking at the big WISR, WBUT, and Rock Station signs, and I'm thinking, wouldn't that be a great place to put the Jeep sign? Maybe talk to Vicky and see if she wants to play along, because that would be an awesome place for it.
That's
she's
a good
close
idea.
To the Jeep. It's close to the building where the Jeeps were built. It's in that neighborhood. It would be great.
Yeah. Yeah, possibility. Okay. Thanks, my friend.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you, David. Bye.
Sure. 283-2525. I didn't think about that before those two callers, but I'm hearing them. Yeah. I'm hearing them. And, you know, who knows what goes through the minds of, you know, goofballs that do that, all of those spray cans. I mean, you know, it's just so senseless. Yeah, I was reading a story about some guy in Pittsburgh. He did that, and he was convicted. They caught him finally, and he was painting them legally somewhere. I don't know. It's down by one of the steel mills that whether it was Southside Works or further down the Mon. I don't know. I'll be honest with you. It was in the Post Gazette. I just glanced at the picture and kind of half read the caption and moved on. I don't have a whole lot of time for those vandals. And that previous caller who said graffiti artists is a poor phrase. It is. It is. I mean, that's you ought to throw the book at that people if they catch them. I mean, that's a lot of damage. A lot of damage. And to what purpose? You know? To what purpose? I was driving along the bypass this past weekend, I believe. Must have been Saturday morning. And I don't know what stretch of the bypass it was. I didn't see the sign that PennDOT always puts up, you know, where the next mile or 2 miles is policed by, using old military terminology there, policed by the litter pickup is done by such and such a group, you know, Lions Club, whatever. But there they were. They had a whole bunch of people. There must have been 20 of them with their yellow fluorescent vests. And each had a plastic bag and a pickup stick, and they were picking up trash along the bypass. I mean, it's good that we do that. It's good that we have groups who volunteer to do that on a regular basis, you know, two or three times a year, whatever they do it, I suppose. Depends on how heavily traveled the road is. But who the heck tosses stuff out the window of their car anymore? I mean, don't we realize that that's just moronic behavior? Really. It's just stupid. I mean, how lazy can you be? How inconsiderate? I don't care whether you're lazy or not. How inconsiderate of others can you be to toss your stuff out the window like that? But the reason I know they were busy, it must have been near the end of their, I don't know, it must have started at 6 o'clock in the morning. But they had bag after bag after bag. When they get a bag filled up, they just, you know, tie this drawstring and sit it on the edge of the road. And then I assume that a PennDOT truck comes around the next day and picks up the bags. But I want to tell you, it was a pretty short stretch of the bypass, maybe 3/4 of a mile. And they had sure picked up a ton of trash. Happy to see it being done. Sad to see that people would toss out that much garbage, that much trash along the roadway. Okay, we need to take a break here. When we come back, Russia's been in the news a lot. My goodness, every day you turn on the news and there it is, Russia connection. Is there a Russian connection? Did the Russians hack us? We're going to be talking about not Russian hacking or the Russian connection. We're going to be talking about one of the most notorious of the Russian dictators, the late Joseph Stalin, specifically his daughter. Yes, he had a daughter. Her name Svetlana, and she lived much of her life in the United States. How did that happen? Tough life, by the way. We'll talk to historian Rosemary Sullivan next, still later on the program today, talking about heart disease with Dr. Joel Fuhrman. That's all coming up on the It's Your Turn program here on WISR. Stick around. We'll be back in a minute.
Hop the bus. Leave the driving up to us.
The bus.
We're going your way. Getting there starts here. Just hop the bus. Easy and economical. Just hop the bus. No car, no problem. The bus will get you there. 'Cause that's what we do. Hop the bus. Leave the driving up to us.
The bus.
We're going your way.
Welcome, listeners. Nice to have you with us. And on this segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR, my name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest visits with us by telephone. She is author Rosemary Sullivan, who has written a fascinating, fascinating book about Stalin's daughter. In fact, that's the title, Stalin's Daughter. Rosemary Sullivan, nice to meet you. Nice to have you with us for a few minutes here today.
Thank you for inviting me.
I think most people are aware of the fact that Joseph Stalin had a daughter. She was in the news occasionally when she lived in the United States. I knew of her name. I knew nothing else until I got the review copy of your book. What a tortured and fascinating life, huh?
Absolutely. Some reviewers have called it a kind of epic life. The momentum never stops.
Yes. Well, let's talk a little bit about, first of all, your research. This is a biography that obviously could not have been written until the breakup of the Soviet Union. You did have access to some of the papers of decades gone by, did you not?
I had access to FBI files, NARA files, wonderful files under Freedom of Information in the United States. By the time I was in Russia in 2013, KGB files were already closed, so no, I did not have access to the secret police files. What I had access to were the state files, which were wonderful. I had the correspondence, which I don't think has been seen in full before, between Svetlana and her father from when she was 7 to when she was about 16. I had access to the correspondence between Nadia, his wife, and Stalin before she committed suicide in 1932. And actually, at the Hoover Institute in California, there was a collection of Svetlana's papers, which included some KGB documents that Svetlana herself had somehow managed to obtain. The only explanation, of course, is that they were obtained for her through the CIA. In fact, I was just going to add that in addition to that, I was able to do 40 interviews with individuals in the Soviet Union in Russia with
Stalin's grandson, Sasha Brodomsky, with a number of her cousins, with people in Georgia, and then friends in London, and with the CIA officer, Robert Rail, in the United States, and people right across the United States, including her daughter, Olga, who, of course, now is Chris Evans. And some of these people have since passed away. So, in fact, it was a moment of serendipity, just the moment when you could write this book.
It's difficult to imagine what it would have been like to have been born as the daughter of Joseph Stalin. And, in fact, as you detail many, many times in your book, Svetlana Aliyeva carried this oppressive weight around with her for her entire life, didn't she?
She said, in fact, that no matter where I go, to an island, to Australia, I will always be the political prisoner of my father's name. Though she also said that you can't regret your life, though I do regret my mother didn't marry a carpenter. So she had a kind of strange humor with which she dealt with this. But it was impossible for people to meet her and not think immediately, Stalin's daughter. The projection was always there. She could never escape it.
Yeah. We're talking, listeners, with Rosemary Sullivan, who has written an incredibly researched and detailed biography of Stalin's daughter, the extraordinary and tumultuous life of Svetlana Aliyeva. A little bit about, and obviously we're just scratching the surface here in the brief time that we have available, Rosemary, but Svetlana was born in 1926. I understand she was Joseph Stalin's favorite child.
She was the little butterfly, the mosca, she was the one who could quiet him down in his rages by wrapping her little hands around his boots. After her mother's death, he told her, never ask command, and called himself her first secretary. So she would write little notes saying, first secretary, take me to the movies. And he would write back, of course I will, your loving papa, the poor peasant Joseph Stalin. So there was this kind of cat and mouse game that was played between them. But the first part of Svetlana's life was magical. Of course, she was the princess in the Kremlin. They had the Zubalovo dacha, where it was a kind of Chekhov-like life. Grandfathers, grandmothers, relatives visiting. And then everything went dark when Stalin initiated the terror of the late 30s.
And, of course, her youth had its tragedies as well. She was only 6 years old, just over 6 years old, when her mother, Nadia, committed suicide, but she never knew that it was a suicide until much, much later. She was never told.
It's hard to imagine, isn't it, the secrecy that Stalin could exert in the Kremlin. All the organs, as they were called, the secret police, knew that it had been suicide, but nobody was allowed to speak. And in the family, though some family members knew it was suicide, nobody ever said that. So Svetlana thought her mother had died of appendicitis until at the age of 16 in 1942, when she was encouraged to read English papers. She read in an American magazine that her mother had committed suicide. So she ran to her grandmother and said, Grandma, is it true? And Grandma Olga said, yes. How could she do that? And at that moment, the blackness of being abandoned by your mother, let alone having to deal with the volatility of your papa, confronted Svetlana.
Well, you can easily see how her life began to fall apart in many ways, even early on. She was married twice and divorced twice while still in her early 20s. Wow, wow.
Well, you know, at the age of 16, she fell in love with a famous filmmaker, Alexei Kapler. And when her father found out, it was a platonic affair, as only a 16-year-old can have. When her father found out, he had Kapler arrested, sent to the Lublyanka for a year of solitary confinement, and then off to the Gulag. And Svetlana understood that was personal. It was Papa doing that. And then after that, she married her school friend, Muratsov, and her father was so angry that he refused ever to meet his son-in-law, and he only met his grandson four times. The alienation between Svetlana and her father began then. But her second marriage was a kind of a marriage of dynasties. It was initiated by her father, and she accepted it. It was a man called Yuri Zhdanov, who was the son of one of his ministers. and it only lasted 2 years. But, you know, divorce in the Soviet Union at that time was a pretty common affair. People went, the role of being the single mother left with the children was pretty common then.
We're talking, listeners, with Rosemary Sullivan, author of Stalin's Daughter. We need to take a quick break. We'll continue our conversation with Rosemary Sullivan right after these words.
Butler Health System is more than a community hospital. It's a community of expertise trusted by our neighbors across the region. For renowned surgeon Dr. Tony Maloof, that means his neighbors are connected to a modern network of exceptional care.
While I'm part of a very close-knit group, I'm also a part of something bigger. Every day, I can see the difference this makes for my patients and for me.
But in its heart, Butler Health System retains the genuine caring of a community hospital, where patients are treated like friends and neighbors, because that's exactly who they are. And for orthopedic surgeon Thomas Mazzanegro, that caring is where it all begins.
We're committed to providing the absolute best care, and that means understanding what's important in the lives of our patients.
At BHS, we know what it takes to provide the very best of care. But more importantly, we know why we have to. Caring hands, remarkable minds. That's Butler Health System.
Welcome back, listeners. Nice to have you with us on the It's Your Turn program today. If you're joining us a little bit late in this segment, my name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest visiting with us by telephone is Rosemary Sullivan, author of a heavily researched biography of Stalin's Daughter, The Extraordinary and Tumultuous Life of Svetlana Aliyeva. So she was married twice, divorced twice in her early 20s. Her father, of course, was still alive at this time. Joseph Stalin didn't die until the early 50s. Did he die a natural death, by the way?
He did. It was really a cerebral hemorrhage. He died in 1953. It was 5 slow days of dying. And one of the impressive things, Svetlana writes about that in her memoir, 20 Letters to a Friend, was his very last gesture was one of rage and what she felt was defiance at the world and at death, though, in fact, Khrushchev, who was standing beside, thought it was simply the last gesture of a dying organism. But, it was a very dramatic death.
Did the shift in power, and it was pretty dramatic after Stalin died, did that, obviously, that affected Svetlana?
Yes, and it was a pretty ruthless shift in power. It should have Beria felt that he would be the replacement for Stalin, and by the summer he was executed, and Khrushchev cemented power. In 1956, as you know, Khrushchev's secret speech was delivered to the Communist Party, and in that secret speech he revealed that Stalin was the one who created the notion of enemies of the people, had people arrested, confessions coerced under torture, and it was an incredible exposure and a complete shock, because Stalin was still the man who had won the Second World War, the great leader. And here was Svetlana sitting at her institute where she was studying, the Gorky Institute, as this speech was read. And can you imagine the impact on her, as all this rage would have been turned against her as Stalin's daughter?
In the mid to late 60s, she walked into the American Embassy in New Delhi, India, seeking asylum. The United States government didn't accept that initially, though, did they? They weren't quite sure what to do with her.
They weren't. When she walked in, one of the things she said, and this is the report of Robert Rail, who was an undercover CIA officer, she said, "Well, you may not believe this, I'm Stalin's daughter." And the consul, George Huey, said, "The Stalin?" They weren't sure whether she was a counter agent, secret infiltrator, or just a crazy woman. And when they sent a telegram to the headquarters, turned out that the CIA, the FBI, or the State Department, none of them had any files on Svetlana Aliyeva, nor did they have any information that Stalin had a daughter. So what did they do with this woman? But the enlightened and remarkable Chester Bowles decided that she had her passport, she had an Indian visa, and he gave her a tourist visa to travel to the United States because she could leave legally. Of course, the Soviets were always convinced it was a CIA plot to kidnap Svetlana. what happened was, on the way to Rome, the Undersecretary of State in the Johnson administration, Foy Kohler, sent a telegram to New Delhi and said, kick her out, have nothing to do with her. But the response from New Delhi was, you're too late, she's already on the plane. So when she got to Rome, instead of proceeding to the United States, the State Department looked for a country to take her, and finally the Swiss took her in, briefly, because then she was finally granted a tourist visa to come to the United States.
And she lived in the United States.
Eventually.
She lived in the United States for a while.
Until she was, until the age of 85. And became an American citizen in 1987.
She was also quite wealthy. I had no idea about this when she arrived in the U.S. She was wealthy because of book sales of her memoir. But then, this is fascinating, it's almost hard to believe, she lost most of her money due to the manipulations of the widow of Frank Lloyd Wright. Holy moly. And you detail all of this incredible story in your book, too.
Yes, absolutely. Well, Svetlana was a Soviet. She did not know what money was. She didn't know there was such a thing as money, nor a public. And suddenly, her memoir was sold for $1.5 million. When she got to the United States, there were more people to greet her at the airport than greeted the Beatles. And she didn't even know how to open a bank account. When she was invited by Olga Vanna Wright to the Taliesin Foundation in 1970, it never occurred to her that she might be the object of a plot. Olga Vanna wanted Svetlana's millions to support her foundation and arranged the marriage between her and the lead architect, Wesley Peters.
Well, she did get a daughter out of that ill-fated relationship, her daughter, Olga. Our time runs
that
short.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Our time runs short. What eventually happened to Svetlana? She died when?
She died in 2011 at the age of 85 in Wisconsin. She was then living in a senior's residence. And according to her daughter, Olga took the name Chris Evans. She changed her name to Chrissy when she was 10 years old because she didn't want to be a Ruski. According to Chris, her mother was reconciled to her life and had a kind of spirituality that was moving. She really affirmed life.
A contradictory figure, an emotional figure, a fascinating life, Stalin's Daughter, by Rosemary Sullivan, who has written biographies, literary criticism, lots of stuff. And she has also recently made an officer of the Order of Canada, the country's highest civilian honor. That was just 3 years ago. For outstanding contributions to Canadian literature and culture. Congratulations on that, Rosemary. That's quite an honor.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for chatting with us today. Also, some marvelous pictures in the book, by the way, including a photograph on the cover with Stalin giving Svetlana a hug, and what a precious smile she has. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you. It was great.
Interesting story, huh? Stalin's Daughter. More to come on the Thursday edition of It's Your Turn. It's clouded up a little bit. I'll have to take a look at the radar, see if there are any showers or thunderstorms in the near future. Certainly a possibility of them today. So we'll take a look at that, let you know. A couple of notes. By the way, our final guest will be joining us in just a few minutes, Dr. Joel Fuhrman. He's an MD, medical doctor. And he's going to be talking about heart disease, specifically how to adjust your diet. For some of us, it might be a pretty radical change in our diet to prevent heart disease, cardiopulmonary disease. So that's coming up a little bit later. He's a pretty well-known guy, Joel Fuhrman. He's been on, set some specials on PBS, Channel 13. And he's been on Dr. Oz and some of the other network TV shows as well. So we'll be chatting with him a little bit later on the program. Tomorrow, we will be chatting with James Martin. He is a Jesuit priest. He's a pretty well-known guy. I first became acquainted with him. He was a semi-regular guest. Well, I wasn't semi-regular. He was a periodic guest on Stephen Colbert's program on Comedy Central. This is before Stephen Colbert got David Letterman's job on Comedy Central. It's called The Colbert Report. It's on every night following The Daily Show. And James Martin was on there on a pretty regular basis. He's also a prolific author. He is the editor-at-large of America Magazine. And he's a Jesuit priest. We'll talk to him tomorrow about his latest book. It concerns the relationship between the church and LGBT Catholics, lesbian, gay, bi-gender and transgender and bisexual individuals. So that's tomorrow. I'm really thrilled to be able to talk with James Martin. He's quite a guy. Also on tomorrow's program, what else do we have on Friday? Oh, Habitat for Humanity. Judy Kerkovich will be here. See what they're doing these days. I haven't talked with anybody from Habitat for Humanity for several years. And we have some other stuff for you on tomorrow's program as well. Just a couple of reminders. Guests that we've had on the program most recently, early this week. It was Monday, I think, that Bill May was here, right? Yeah, Monday. Tonight's the night for his program on the history of Butler's movie theaters. And we just had a call on that today from somebody who wanted to know what time it is and where is it. It's 6:30 tonight, Carousel Shelter at Alameda Park. 6:30 at the Carousel Shelter, multimedia show. Bill said it takes about an hour. So, and by the way, if you don't know where the Carousel Shelter is, it's in the lower level of Alameda Park, lower level, and you're under roof. So just in case the weather does turn a little damp, no trouble. And also, I guess it was a couple of weeks ago, we talked with Jeff Croner about the coming summer concert season for the Musicians Concert Band. And the first concert is tonight at Butler Intermediate High School. I think they're all there. Well, it's an air-conditioned auditorium, so it's great. 7:30, $5 admission there for the first concert, and it features show music. Music from the movies and musicals. Tonight, the Musicians Concert Band. So a couple of notes for you from guests that we've had on the program over the past couple of weeks. Okay, we need to take a break here. And then a conversation with Dr. Joel Furman on heart disease. That's coming up next here on the Thursday edition of It's Your Turn on WISR. We'll be right back.
Each month, Radio PA gives you a chance to send a question or comment to Governor Tom Wolf during our Ask the Governor program. Your input can make a difference, just like Thomas in Center County, who was concerned about the state prison population counting toward the governor's proposed $25 per capita fee for state police coverage.
Prison populations included in these township formulas, is there a way to offset that, or is that just the way it's going?
No, I think Thomas makes a really good point. That's not right. So I will make sure that at least in the proposal that I make, I will modify that we don't count the prison population in that. So I think Thomas makes a very good point. Thank you for that good question.
You can be a part of the next Ask the Governor program by going to pamatters.com and clicking the Ask the Governor link at the top of the page. You can also email the program directly at askthegov@pamatters.com. That's askthegov, G-O-V, at pamatters.com. Ask the Governor is an exclusive presentation of Radio Pennsylvania and pamatters.com.
Going to be talking about heart disease, listeners, on the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. If you're joining us a little bit late, my name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest visits with us by telephone today. He is Dr. Joel Furman, MD, a New York Times bestselling author, and for the purposes of our conversation today, author of a new book entitled The End of Heart Disease. Dr. Furman, nice to talk with you. Nice to have you with us for a few minutes here today.
Well, thanks, Dave. Thanks for having me on.
In your book, The End of Heart Disease, you say that 95% of heart disease is curable, and you can do it by eating correctly.
That's right, and I'd say that 95% is a way conservative figure. I actually, you know, think it's much more than that. I just can't prove it 100%. But, of course, we know there are islands around the world, like the Catawba Island, who eats more primitively without processed foods, and they have zero heart disease, zero high blood pressure, no overweight people. None of the 23,000 people on that island, none of them in their ancestry ever had heart disease or heart problems. The point is that we have proven nutritional interventions today that's been shown to drop blood pressure radically and actually reverse obstructive coronary artery disease. And so we're talking about nutritional excellence being infinitely more protective than medications and invasive medical procedures. And it should be the first choice of advice from any physician for any person coming in with high blood pressure, high cholesterol, or even advanced heart disease, which we now know is reversible through nutrition and more effectively reversible than through medical procedures.
I just want to correct myself. I think I may have misspoke in my earlier comment. Your book shows that 95% of heart disease-related deaths are preventable, not necessarily heart disease.
I think that's a good correction. And I just want to, you know, stay here that I published this, you know, there was a study published in the October 15, 2015 issue of the American Journal of Lifestyle Medicine that showed out of 443 people following a nutritarian diet, that the blood systolic blood pressure lowered an average of 26 points systolic, which is not even close to any other study ever done. You know, better, more powerful than drugs. And the point is, when you lower your blood pressure and cholesterol and body weight with a dietary excellence, you reduce your heart attack risk in the future 100 times more than benefits that you would get from medications. Medications in most studies show between 10 to 20% reduction in heart attack risk and stroke risk, and we're talking here about dramatic reductions, close, you know, over 90% reduction, maybe close to 98% reduction in risk, because obviously I gave many examples in those studies and other studies of people, even with advanced heart disease, showing that obstructive plaque was reversed, and the most dangerous plaque, the vulnerable plaque that causes heart attack, is reversed first and most quickly over the stable, more obstructive plaque that doesn't cause heart attacks that the angioplasties and bypass surgeries treat. It's why they don't show extension of lifespan in people with stable coronary artery disease. So we're talking here about informed consent. If people got comprehensive informed consent, that means if they knew the risks of the medications, how they increase the risk of cancer, which we can talk about, and how comparatively ineffective they were compared to dietary changes, then people, I think millions and millions of more people would choose to make the dietary changes necessary to protect their health.
You used a word that may not be familiar to most of us, nutritarian. What do you mean by that, Dr. Furman?
Right. A nutritarian is obviously a coined word that's in use today that I coined many years ago that describes a diet that's designed to maximally extend human lifespan to offer protection against heart disease, strokes, dementia, and cancers. And that most of the chronic diseases and most of the premature deaths in the modern world today come from nutritional ignorance and dietary practices that shorten human lifespan. And nutritional science has made such advances in the last couple of decades that we can add many, many years. We're talking about 15 to 20 years to average lifespan while we give protection against chronic disease like high blood pressure, diabetes, and of course strokes and cancers, that nutritional excellence is the most powerful therapeutic intervention and should be the primary or foundational, we should say, therapeutic modality of physicians and health advisors. And I'm all for a person doing whatever they want. If they want to snort cocaine or smoke cigarettes, go right ahead. And if they want to take drugs for the rest of their life to control their blood pressure and eat conventional American food, they could do that. But the problem is, they don't know the data and they don't know this information. It's kept hidden from people that they don't know the proven efficacy of these nutritional approaches and their safety, their incredible safety and effectiveness compared to medication. So people aren't giving the information they need. We're talking about they don't have informed consent. They don't have the information they need to make adequate decision. A perfect example might be, let's say, people put on calcium channel blockers for lowering blood pressure. We know that high blood pressure is the first sign of heart disease, and if you have atherosclerotic plaque and stiffening of the blood vessels, it increases your risk of heart attacks and strokes. And people put on calcium channel blockers, women, for example, 10 years or more, show double the risk of breast cancer. Was that person informed of that risk? and they told of how more effective it would have been if they made a dietary change. So we're talking here about some really important issues that are critical for the future of medical care in this country.
Well, obviously, there's a great deal of detail in your new book, The End of Heart Disease. I just want to take a couple of things to talk about. First of all, foods that you say we should enjoy every day, and then foods that we should avoid at all costs. So first of all, can you give us some foods that we should enjoy every day, Doctor?
Well, that's a great question, too, because I have an acronym which I made to make it really easy for people to remember the foods with the most powerful longevity-promoting effects, so they can have them on the tip of their tongue, so they can try to incorporate it in their diet every day. And if people did this, it would like change America's healthcare crisis. It would be revolutionize healthcare. And the word is G-bombs. G-B-O-M-B-S. And it stands for greens, beans, onions, mushrooms, berries, and seeds. Greens, beans, onions, mushrooms, berries, and seeds. And we can talk about any one of those numbers or letters here today, but let's just take flax seeds, for example, mm-hmm. as an example of a seed. Flax seeds have been shown that if people taking, you know, 1 to 2 tablespoons a day, a study show it lowers systolic blood pressure about 15 points. That's more powerful than medications. You see, and the point is when you tomato paste or tomatoes, it lowers blood pressure, I think, about 5 points, but the effect on stroke reduction is about 59%, which is much greater. So even though you don't get as much blood pressure lowering effect as a drug, the effect on stroke reduction from tomato paste or tomato sauce is greater. The same thing with flax seeds. Even though the effect on systolic blood pressure is great, but when you do this naturally and through excellent food choices, the amount of protection you get is much greater than what you would expect from the blood pressure lowering effects. In other words, it overwhelms drugs. And then take into account that a recent study giving flax seeds to women who had breast cancer over a 10-year period showed that women had a 71% reduced risk of death from breast cancer who had breast cancer over that 10-year period compared to women who'd had no lignans from flax in their diet. The lignans are the protective anti-cancer part of flax. And even if you consider that study, the women in the study were only eating about a third of a milligram of lignin a day, and a teaspoon of flax seeds has 7 milligrams of lignans in it, which is much greater than that. And of course, we know that starting these interventions after you have cancer is not even going to be as effective as you started them earlier, when the things were earlier before they got to that advanced stage. So it underestimates the benefits. So I'm saying that there are these foods which have miraculous protective longevity-promoting effects, and everybody in America should be doing these things now.
G-bombs, an easy G-bombs. Way to remember foods we should enjoy every day. We need to take a quick break here. We have a few more minutes, listeners, who are able to chat with Dr. Joel Fuhrman. And when we come back, we'll ask him about what foods we should avoid at all costs. You're listening to It's Your Turn on WISR. Back right after these words.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick 2 is 4141. The pick 3, 745, 745. The pick 4, 1625. The pick 5, 36224. The wild ball for each of those is 3. The treasure hunt, 3, 4, 7, 20, and 24. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $50,000.
Moving from my home of 50 years was a little scary, but I wasn't safe at home anymore, and my daughter with her busy life, children and grandchildren, it wasn't fair for me to expect so much from her.
We looked together to find a new home and discovered New Haven Court at Clearview.
What made the difference were the employees and the residents we met. The residents said it was a great place to live.
New Haven Court at Clearview, a great place to live because it's a great place to work. 888-261-5753 or visit IntegraCare.com.
Welcome back, listeners. If you're joining us a little bit late on this segment of It's Your Turn, welcome. My name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest, Dr. Joel Fuhrman, MD, author of The End of Heart Disease. We talked before the break, Doctor, about what foods you think we should enjoy every day. What's the flip side? What foods should we avoid at all costs?
Well, you know, keep in mind that the American diet, let's look at what Americans eat right now, and Americans are eating 54% of calories from processed foods like bread and pasta and salad oil, mayonnaise, donuts, cookies, crackers, breakfast bars, chips, soft drinks, candy, you know, crackers. This is what Americans eat. That's 54%. And these foods are in the processing don't have any micronutrient load or phytochemicals or antioxidants, and then Americans eat 32% of calories from animal products. We don't eat any produce in this country, less than 5% of the American diet. But there's two things here. One is that everybody knows that we are consuming too much salt, and that we should eat a low-salt diet to prevent against high blood pressure and heart attacks and strokes, but what they don't recognize is that when you get most of your fat intake from nuts and seeds, we're talking about a whole food that grows on trees, nuts and seeds, versus the oils or animal fats, the oils taken from those nuts and seeds, completely different biological effects, because when you take your fat from nuts and seeds, it's fed into the body very gradually over many hours, and the body can preferentially burn it for energy as opposed to storing it as body fat. And so the different biological effects, instead of pouring oil over your food, you make a salad dressing maybe with some tomato sauce whipped with some almonds and sunflower seeds with some balsamic or fig vinegar with a fig or a raisin in there and some roasted garlic, or you make a dressing from whipping up peeled oranges with some lemon juice or some blood orange vinegar and cashews and toasted sesame seeds. In other words, we're talking here about utilizing nuts and seeds as your major fat intake source. So that's been proven to have a dramatic effect at reducing sudden cardiac death and extending human lifespan to the max. So that's, I just want to make that clear. But the other things we want to avoid are things like, of course, processed meats, trans fats, liquid sweets. In other words, I'm really advocating people are against foods that have a high glycemic load, which would include not just conventional sweeteners like sugar, but also things like honey and maple syrup, even agave nectar. Most of our sweetener, or almost all our sweeteners, should come from either fresh fruit or the conservative use of dried fruit. And I can show people how to make delicious ice creams and delicious desserts by using the fruit and a little bit of dried fruit. For example, a delicious vanilla ice cream by whipping up some frozen bananas with some vanilla or a non-alcoholic vanilla extract with some walnuts or macadamia nuts in there, and maybe one date per person with a frozen banana with the vanilla. Incredibly delicious ice creams and delicious, you know. So we're not talking about giving up pleasure in life. We're talking about retraining the taste and relearning a different way of cooking that enables you to get the full nutrient benefit out of food, protect your health in the process, and have a much more productive and happier life.
By the way, you devote a portion of your book to a bunch of recipes, dinners, brunches, desserts, snacks, and everything. So if you're interested in that, there's much more in the end of heart disease. What would you say, Dr. Joel Furman, to people who are listening to us and they say, this approach seems pretty severe to me. I don't know whether I can do it.
I know that that's what people could be thinking. They could think, you know, this sounds logical, it sounds scientific, sounds important, but it's not for me. I'm too old, I'm too white, I don't like vegetables, blah, blah, blah. They have a million excuses, but, you know, we recognize that food is very addicting and highly palatable, highly seasoned, you know, sugary foods. Sugar is addicting, and it's the addiction talking, and people come up with irrational reasons why they shouldn't change. And I'm saying to you that, you know, again, we published a study published in the Nutrition Journal 2012. Out of more than 750 people, 1 6 months passed, people were reported that they enjoyed this way of eating as much or more as their prior diet. There's not a loss of pleasure. That's a myth. It's temporarily, does take some time for your taste buds to readjust and to learn the recipes and things. But, you know, is something that's going to add 15 to 20 years of your life and protect you from medical tragedies and not have be having your children have to take care of you in later life? I mean, we don't get something for nothing. There's some effort involved in creating good health. Then the point I'm making is that we can control our health destiny. It's not easy, and to afford this degree of protection I'm offering people and saying, you know, you're not going to have heart attacks or strokes, you have to achieve a normal blood pressure without medication, a normal cholesterol without medication, a normal blood glucose without diabetic medications, and a normal body weight, and it does take, you know, quite a significant dietary change to do that, but this is fun. This is tasty. This is exciting. This is rewarding. And you don't have to be on these toxic medications with all these side effects for the rest of your life, because people think they're given these drugs like they have to take them forever and there's no other option. And I'm saying there is an option, and this option is tasty, delicious, and it's fun, and you'd be very foolish not to try it and learn more about it. And if you learn more, we find the people that educate themselves in this love it, and they're able to do it.
We've kind of outlined the nutritarian approach, obviously much more detail in Dr. Furman's book, The End of Heart Disease. A couple of quick questions here. What about aspirin? What about a glass of red wine? I've read about this stuff. Could you comment on either of those?
Well, yeah, you don't get, you know, it's like you don't get something for nothing. And obviously it's better to eat right and be healthy and not have to take aspirin, because aspirin may reduce your risk slightly, but it also comes with risks. Increased risk of hemorrhagic stroke, which could be devastating and put you in a nursing home the rest of your life. Increased risk of gastrointestinal bleeding. In other words, there are some benefits, but and the benefits for certain people might outweigh those risks. But they're not going to be a benefit. The best benefit-risk ratio is not there anymore when you eat right. And with red wine, I mean, I think most of the studies showing a benefit of red wine for heart disease are just not, or just poorly done studies as association risk. We know that, for example, even one glass of red wine a day for women increases the risk of breast cancer between 10 and 15%. So the alcohol is carcinogenic, and there is some negative effects of drinking. But I'm not here to say people, it's not the main issue about this, and that could be a personal choice. Personally, I'd rather people, you know, avoid alcohol or stay with, you know, or have it, or stay within that 2 to 3 glass limit a week so as not to increase any breast cancer risk. But of course, that's a personal decision, but it's not going to afford people major protection against heart attack or stroke either way. So it's not going to be the major determinant of their lifespan.
What about fish? I mean, we hear that that's good, but you tell people to limit their fish intake to 6 ounces or less per week. Why is that, doctor?
That's right. I want people to, well, it depends on the person, but certainly, you know, not rigidly 6 ounces a week, but I do want them to be, I want the general public to be under 10% of total calories from animal products, which is usually under 8 to 10 ounces a week of animal products, except for the fact that when you're using white meat or fishes, the calories are only 50 calories an ounce as opposed to 100 calories an ounce with more red meat, so they can eat a little more fish than they could for red meat, for example, and it wouldn't be 6 ounces. It would be a greater amount. But nevertheless, we're still saying that these things should not be consumed in large amounts, because in today's world, they have PCBs and dioxin and mercury and other pollutive items in them. And we also want to keep animal protein to a certain limit to make sure the IGF-1 or insulin-like growth factor 1 is favorable, because too much protein in the diet, animal protein in particular, raises IGF-1, which drives angiogenesis and cellular replication and growth, which can promote the growth of tumors and cancers. So we want to have the diet be largely plant-based with high nutrient vegetation, and animal products more as a condiment or a smaller amount, and fish is still not unlimited. It still gives you too much protein and too much pollution. It can be used as smaller amounts in a diet and still be used favorably.
One very final question. What about exercise? Do you recommend any particular type of exercise as being best for the heart?
Well, you know, the funny thing is that so many people we see with diabetes that reverse their diabetes, and people that were overweight and lose 100 pounds, they can't exercise effectively. And I want to don't give them the impression that if they can't do this exercise, they're not going to get better, because they can. And the reality is that, and the results are that most people feel so good after doing this for a few months, they feel like exercising. But the best type of exercising, to answer your question, is weight-bearing exercises, where you're walking, jogging, an elliptical machine, being upright in your feet, not sitting, you know. So we're talking here about, you know, and whatever people do is better than nothing, and they don't have to kill themselves and become professional athletes, but it is be good if they can incorporate exercise in their lifestyle on a regular basis within their own capacity and limitations of what they're capable of.
I'll tell you, some people might think this sounds severe, but boy, the color pictures on the cover of your book, The End of Heart Disease, carrots, tomatoes, greens, nuts and seeds, looks pretty appetizing. Makes me pretty hungry, Dr. Furman.
Where do you taste some of those recipes we put together? Don't forget, I've been doing this for 25 years. There are Nutritarian restaurants around this whole country that we have great chefs contributing recipes to. That this is an incredibly delicious way to eat, and it's not like we're giving up pleasure in life to live longer. We're living longer with maximum pleasure in life. And it removes fear. Fear, we know that we're in control and not running to hospitals and being dependent on doctors and medical procedures. So it's, you know, it's a growing, how should I say, a lot of people are excited about this, and a lot of more physicians are getting into it. It's a very growing field in the field of lifestyle medicine today.
Maybe you've seen him, listeners, on Dr. Oz, the Today Show, Good Morning America, even on his own PBS shows. Dr. Joel Furman, MD, our guest for the last few minutes here on It's Your Turn, his latest book entitled The End of Heart Disease. Thanks, Dr. Furman. Nice to talk with you.
Oh, thanks so much. Best to you and your listeners.
Sure. So long now. Nice to talk with Dr. Joel Furman. I have seen him on TV, yeah, a couple of times. And earlier, Rosemary Sullivan, historian Rosemary Sullivan, with a very, very interesting recounting of the life of Svetlana Ololueva, daughter of Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin lived much of her adult life in America. Didn't know that. Coming up on tomorrow's program, it'll be the Friday edition, of course, if it's your turn. We have several guests, among them the Reverend James Martin, Jesuit priest, prolific author. We'll talk about his latest book. He's also the editor-at-large of America Magazine. And he was recently appointed to head of a communication commission at the Vatican with the Pope. James Martin with us tomorrow. Also among our guests tomorrow, we have guests from the Habitat for Humanity here locally with us on tomorrow's program as well. So we'll have a good time. We'll have some other stuff, too.